I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
And welcome to Radio Times. In June 2002, John McQuaid and Mark Schlefstein wrote an award-winning series for the New Orleans Times-Picayune called Washing Away. It predicted what would happen to that city if it were hit by a major hurricane. They warned about the effects of coastal erosion, the structural problems with the levee system, and the difficulty the city would face trying to evacuate its residents after the streets became flooded. 3 years later, McQuaid and Schlefstein's vision of disaster turned out to be true. They've written a new book called Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans, and The Coming Age of Superstorms. It's about a number of things, including the handful of local officials and scientists who had warned of a coming catastrophe and the consequences of the action and inaction of the bureaucrats, politicians, and engineers who ignored them. McQuaid and Schlefstein were part of the team of Times-Picayune journalists who won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of Katrina and its aftermath. John McQuaid joins us this morning on Radio Times from NPR's New York Bureau. John McQuaid, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. What was the reaction to your series in New Orleans when it was published back in June 2002?
I think it scared a lot of people. People had heard the scenario of New Orleans being destroyed by a flood filling the bowl, as it came to be known. But the people didn't really take it seriously. And so I think we gave a lot of people pause. And it got some attention in the government in terms of coastal restoration. People were seeking money to rebuild the coastline. But in terms of rebuilding the levees and other issues, it really wasn't that gripping to people in the government.
Well, and this was one of a series of reports. There had been some storm surge models. There was the Hurricane Pam exercise. Again, really predicting, as you two were predicting, what would happen to New Orleans if hit by a major storm.
Yes. It was filtering up at various levels of government, but it was never a priority either at the upper levels of the Bush administration or in the Congress, which, of course, holds the purse strings for things like that.
Why? Why do you think that your series of articles and these other predictions were not taken seriously?
It's a number of things, but typically, if you're a politician and you're dealing with a risk that is not imminent, then you're more likely to cross your fingers and say, well, this might not happen for 20 years, so I'm not going to do anything because, you know, it'll be a lot of effort for not much payoff, and, you know, we have other more immediate priorities. So it's just a cross your fingers type of mentality.
I mean, is that wishful thinking on people's parts?
Yes. I mean, obviously, if people had paid more attention, the city might have been saved, or we might have had a better rescue effort, a better evacuation effort.
President Bush appeared on television, in fact, interviewed by Diane Sawyer just a few days after the levees broke, and he said, and I'm quoting here, "I don't think anyone anticipated the breach of the levees." With that statement, that means that some of these reports really didn't filter up to the White House.
No, I think there was a lot of confusion all that week about just what the conditions were in New Orleans. Even though the information about the levees breaching was communicated up to the highest levels pretty soon after on that first day, people at the upper levels surrounding the president and in the Homeland Security Department really didn't know that much about the geography of New Orleans or the difference between levees being breached or just overtopped by a storm surge. So I think the president's statement just reflected that ongoing confusion, which, and part of it was that they didn't know beforehand. They should have paid more attention, I think, to the New Orleans scenario. And part of it was that everything just fell apart when the storm hit.
Is there any satisfaction that you can say we told you so?
I mean, it's given what happened, it's not really the type of thing to feel satisfied about. I mean, we were devastated when this happened. My co-author Mark Schlefstein lost his house, it's just an overwhelming event, which we're still muddling through. So,
well, there are many things in your book that I do want to talk about, and one is to take a hard look at the Army Corps of Engineers, and I get the feeling that you and your co-author really hold them ultimately responsible for the problems in New Orleans and all the sort of fallout of this levee system that was constructed. Is that a pretty fair analysis of your perspective on the Army Corps of Engineers?
They were handed the responsibility of protecting New Orleans and other coastal cities, and in this case, they failed, and they admitted that they failed. There were design errors in these flood walls that fell down and flooded most of the city. So most of the flooding from Katrina is directly attributable to human errors by people at the Corps of Engineers and their contractors. So it's a very, they bear ultimate responsibility for that.
You talk about the difficulty of constructing a levee system there, just how different the soil is, one section of soil next to another.
It's very tricky stuff. Because it's a swamp, you have all these layers from geological history. You have old stuff from the 19th century and the 18th century kind of embedded in it. And during a flood, water penetrates this and it goes through all these layers. So you have to, get a wall or a levee to stand upright and be stable, and B, you have to make sure that during this flood event it stays up and there aren't weak points where that water can rush through and the whole thing just washes out.
And in hindsight, is New Orleans, is that a pretty bad place to put a city?
You could see why they did it. It was strategically located near the mouth of the Mississippi. And originally they did locate where the French Quarter is now on the high ground. But over the years, if you want to have a big American city there, you really have to take steps to protect it.
And those steps would not include levees, or would it include a different kind of levee system?
If you really want to protect it now, you have to make a major investment in a levee system that will include more high-tech kinds of things like floodgates computers to monitor storm surges and also combine it with some serious coastal restoration so you preserve this very delicate, valuable landscape that is out there. So, and that's a really ambitious venture, which obviously everybody in New Orleans is hoping that the U.S. government and the local government can undertake.
And the levee system was built in response to Hurricane Betsy, which devastated parts of New Orleans. This was back in 1965.
That's correct. And Betsy hit, had a very similar flooding pattern to Katrina. It flooded the Ninth Ward and St. Bernard Parish and eastern New Orleans, flooded the central part of New Orleans much, much less. And President Johnson came down immediately after the storm and saw all this damage, went up on a bridge and saw scenes very similar to what we saw last year. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the government got into the act and said, well, we're not going to let this happen again. And so they embarked on this ambitious levee system.
But was this levee system designed to protect the residents of New Orleans and the surrounding region, or was it to promote development in the region?
A little bit of both. The Corps of Engineers, of course, its original mission, aside from building military structures, was to promote navigational projects around the country. And every project, including levees designed to protect human lives, had to have some economic justification. And that's still the case today. Basically, Eastern New Orleans, they built a levee. There was hardly anybody living there, and they built the levee and said, well, we're going to build this. We want people to come in, move here. We want businesses here, and that's the justification for building the levee. Of course, Eastern New Orleans was subsequently almost wiped out.
But by having this dual purpose, did that create the problems that we saw last year?
Yeah, that's part of the problem. The Corps has not, at least up to now, included potential loss of human life in all its elaborate justifications, and nor did it really take account of the possibility of a complete catastrophic failure, which, of course, is vastly more economically costly than anything included in their calculations.
But the coastal erosion that has been observed, and even this combination of both sinking land and rising seas, is that a result of this levee system built in New Orleans and then, of course, in the Gulf region there?
It's a result of the river levee system, which was built starting in the 19th century, because every year there were river floods, and they wanted to secure the river so there could be economic growth, and navigation, and so the people could live there, farming could proceed. So they built these big levees, and the river delta juts out into the Gulf of Mexico. It depends on being replenished every year by silt, you know, from the heartland that comes down the river, overflows the banks, builds it up again. Once the river was levied, that stopped, and the natural process is that earth tends to sink. This is particularly squishy earth, and so it sinks faster and compresses, and so once the silt was cut off, it all began sinking much faster than it had ever before. You had other kinds of development, which, you know, they took oil and gas out of the ground, they carved it up with channels and other types of man-made changes, and so that further accelerated it. So you had this very striking, rapid change going on, where if you go to these areas, they look dramatically different than they did even a decade ago.
And literally, you've got land sinking and seas rising, so you've got levees holding in water that's well above the land. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, water is slowly encroaching on the New Orleans area. If you go outside of New Orleans 10 or 20 miles, you know, you'll see water where you didn't 10 or 20 years ago. During a flood, you know, you'll get water all the way up to New Orleans, depending on where the storm surge is coming from. So you end up with almost a Venice type of situation, which, of course, is very, very dangerous.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. John McQuaid is our guest, and he's co-author with Mark Schlefstein of a new book called Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. And he was part of the team of journalists at the New Orleans Times-Picayune who won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of Katrina and its aftermath. And, of course, coming up on the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, he joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation, talk more about the effect of this levee system on New Orleans and the Delta region, and also talk about some of the politics of the hurricane last year. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This fall, all New Jersey high school athletes will face mandatory drug testing for steroid use. We'll look at the increase in steroid use among teens and how that's affecting high school athletics. We'll hear from the U.S. Drug Czar's office about the state of drug use among teenagers. Are anti-drug ads effective in stopping teens from doing drugs? Drugs and drug testing in America's high schools, this week on Justice Talking.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
After serving as the first woman priest in an Episcopal church in a small town in Georgia, Barbara Brown Taylor resigned from parish ministry to teach religion. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the political and spiritual reasons why. Her book is called Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
What do your friends mean to you?
I think friendship's very important, as I believe it helps define you as a person.
Most of my friends have a good sense of humor and just people that enhance your quality of life.
I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll hear about a new book that discusses the state of friendship in America. That's today at noon, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're talking with John McQuaid today on the program, co-author of a new book called Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. I do want to talk more about the Gulf region and even the loss of Barrier Islands, which you and your co-author write about. Help us understand the kind of loss of habitat that's happened in that part of the Gulf region, let's say in the last decade or two.
Well, it really is a very extraordinary landscape if you go out to the Louisiana marshes, because it's really a huge, huge wetland, and they're just stunning vistas out there. But if you go out to these areas, you will see, for example, nutria. These are orange-toothed rodents, which were brought from South America by some enterprising fur traders in the 1930s and escaped and multiplied. And nutria have infested the marshes, and they like to just churn the grass over. So they alone have contributed to the coastal erosion problem. And if you take a boat out, you will see turned over earth and grass, and you could just see even that little piece of it is part of this overall problem. You will go out in other areas and see dying stands of trees. You'll see marsh grass that is turning from green to yellow. You will see large vistas of water where before there was earth and grass. In towns, you will find people telling you that, it used to be we'd get a flood here every generation or so, and now it's every 5-10 years. There's both a dramatic change in the physical surroundings and also the culture down there. A lot of younger people are leaving these areas, and older people, they're reluctant to leave, but some of them are being forced out too. And these changes are migrating slowly, but a little bit quicker every year, towards New Orleans and its suburbs, which are just a few miles away.
You write about how this region and even the Barrier Islands, when they're intact, they can actually protect against a strong storm and a strong a storm surge and some of the heavy winds. Does that explain why, for instance, Katrina was so ferocious, because you didn't have this sort of stop system as it worked its way up this hurricane alley?
That's part of it, although it's important to make a distinction. Barrier islands and marshes are useful mainly as flood control and hurricane protection in repelling floods from weaker storms, your garden variety tropical storm, which has a relatively weak, low storm surge. A storm like Katrina has a giant storm surge, and which will overrun all natural obstacles. I think scientists believe that a marsh will reduce it somewhat, but nobody really knows how much. So to stop that type of storm surge, you really need a man-made wall to keep
really?
The water out.
Really? I mean, the way it is in the Netherlands, for instance?
Yes. I mean, in the Netherlands, they've been fighting storm surges and river flooding for 1,000 years. And they've learned some hard lessons. Most recently, in the early 1950s, there was a devastating storm surge flood. And they responded by building these very elaborate structures to keep the storm surge out of their estuaries. And if you go there, you see these monstrous steel structures that are operated by computer and are quite dramatic and flip into action, you know, at the slightest warning of high water.
And it works. And, I mean, it's been able to protect them since the 50s?
Yes, it has. There's nothing like that in the United States, which has some people worried.
I mean, is that, have you worried? And is that the model that the U.S. should look at in trying to rebuild this region and make it safer because of the threat of hurricanes and big storms?
Very definitely. The Dutch have a lot to teach us in this area. The most important thing is probably that all of these structures have to meet a legal standard for safety, whereas in New Orleans, there was no legal standard really as to how safe something should be. It's like the Corps just pretty arbitrarily said, well, this is what we're going to do. If there's a legal safety, it means even if you're marsh erodes or your circumstances change, you have to monitor that and keep strengthening something if circumstances change.
Well, in fact, you say that what they chose, and there was a lot of political pressure here, was the simplest and the cheapest. This would be the Army Corps.
Right. When they started building the levees, it was the 1960s. There was a lot of money available. But then the thing got bogged down by disputes, by construction delays, and it took over 40 years, or I guess exactly 40 years until Katrina hit. It was still not finished. By the 30-year mark, things had really dragged out. They were looking to save money wherever they could, so they built these flood walls in these canals that fell down. They were really the cheapest type of structure you could put in that area. And they shorted a number of things in the construction, which contributed to their collapse.
Do you think it would be possible, though, to rebuild the delta and rebuild some of these barrier islands to try to bring back some of the sort of natural safety mechanisms of the region?
I think if the region is going to survive both culturally and physically, you do need to do that. Otherwise, you end up with New Orleans surrounded by giant walls and water lapping at the bottom of it, which nobody wants. It is possible. It's possible to rebuild the marshes by essentially putting a gate in the river levee. And you open the gate at various times of the year and allow fresh, silty water to flow out and build up the marsh. You can rebuild barrier islands also. It's partly a question of, is there going to be money available? Is there going to be the technical know-how to knit all these different projects together? It's a very ambitious project to undertake. And can you put it together with good flood protection? So it requires a lot of planning and smart policy and money. And those things we haven't really seen for quite some time in this area.
Well, I'll tell you what, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to shift gears and talk a bit about some of the people that you hold responsible for what happened in New Orleans and the Gulf last year, and that's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist John McQuaid, our guest today on Radio Times, co-author of a new book. His co-author is Mark Schlefstein, and the book is called Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Fred from Philadelphia to join us. Fred, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question for the guest is, something that we as humans have to understand is the more and more we develop these coastal areas, the more we are going to be prone to flooding. And my question is, in light of Katrina, are there other densely populated areas around the country, along the coast, that we need to be concerned about protecting and what needs to be done in order to do that?
Fred, thanks for calling into Radio Times. John, have you looked at other cities besides New Orleans?
Yeah, there are plenty of cities. Depending on the level of that the seas rise in the future, many different cities, including New York, Washington, could be affected. It doesn't take very much water to increase the likelihood of a storm surge in areas that have never really had a problem before. So this is something long-term we have to look at. In the short term, there are a lot of cities which are more immediately vulnerable. Galveston, we saw, was almost hit last year. Houston, a storm surge can come across the land up of the ship channel, Charleston, any city that is exposed and in a low-lying area is vulnerable to a storm surge.
But are we talking about bigger storms, or are we talking about the fact that more and more people have moved into the storm path and in some ways, you know, encouraged to live in places that are going to flood because of flood insurance and things like that?
Both. Over the past 50 years in the post-war period, more and more people have settled along coastlines and also in other vulnerable areas. So the amount of stuff that can be destroyed in a hurricane or other type of natural disaster is much, much greater than it used to be. And this is something that we haven't really recognized as a nation or at the governmental level. We're also going to see more large hurricanes. Everybody agrees on that. There's a debate over the degree to which global warming will amp that up, but we're definitely in a period of more hurricane activity, so we are going to see more big disasters.
Even though it's been a relatively quiet hurricane season so far, there is Tropical Storm Ernesto brewing in the Caribbean, but you know, compared to last year, this year's rather different. Is that significant, do you think?
I mean, any given year is going to be idiosyncratic. You have to look at over a decade or more. Generally speaking, everybody agrees that we're in a period of increased hurricane activity, so we may be having a quiet year, fingers crossed, this year, although the year is not over yet.
No.
We really have to watch out for the future.
Let me get Ann from Mount Airy to join us. Ann, go ahead, your radio times.
Hi. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
I lived in New Orleans in the early 70s, from 71 to 74, and there were no tall buildings in the downtown area. And I was told they can't build tall buildings because they'd have to sink the foundations as deep as the buildings were high, because there's nothing like granite or anything to build foundations on. And over the years, I've seen the skyline of New Orleans and pictures, and I was really shocked to see tall buildings.
And you're wondering if that's
I'm wondering
had an
if
effect?
That building frenzy had anything to do with the Ebola effect, or whether it had any impact on the ability of the city to handle all that water.
What do you think, John McQuaid? Thanks, Ann.
It did take some time to develop the engineering technology to anchor large buildings in that soft, squishy muck, but they can do it now. I believe it's had some effect in terms of the subsidence, the sinking issue. Obviously, if you put something really heavy on that soil, it's going to compress faster than if you didn't put that up. But I don't think it had a significant effect on the flooding.
You and your co-author look at the local response and at the New Orleans level, the state response, and the federal response as well. Who held ultimate responsibility for what happened to New Orleans and how the people were supposed to get rescued and all of that? I mean, bottom line, who was responsible? Maybe that's the problem.
I think in terms of the response to the disaster, we would put more responsibility on the president and the mayor than on the other players involved. The mayor was responsible for the evacuation effort. That's the way things work in most places. The local official is in charge of getting people out. And the problem of people without transportation, many of them poor people, old people, people who don't travel much, was well known. We reported on it. Others reported on it. They looked at it during the Hurricane Pam exercise. Yet it was never a priority of the Nagin administration.
And why not, do you think? I mean, and again, I mean, this is. I think this is the question that sort of hovers over a conversation like this, because all this was predicted, and yet, as you very clearly say, there wasn't the kind of action to come up with some kind of an action plan.
It's one of those difficult problems, which is not just a logistical challenge, but also a social problem. In other words, you need buses and drivers to get people out. You also need to raise public awareness in these areas where people are not as likely to be connected to the internet or follow the news. And then you have to physically figure out a way to get people out. And if people don't want to go, how do you get them out? So it was one of those problems that I'm sure the mayor thought about, but again, it's the cross-your-fingers mentality. It's a difficult problem. If the storm does not hit and you bug people to leave, then are they going to leave the next time when the real storm hits? So there are all these difficult issues involved, which leads some people in local government who have a lot of problems to just say, oh, well, this is just too difficult. I'll let my colleague handle it, or I'll let the next guy handle it.
Do you think it was a mistake to fold FEMA under the Department of Homeland Security, or was the mistake at the top of FEMA in that you had a director, Michael Brown, who had no disaster experience whatsoever before he got this job?
Well, we think Mike Brown got a little bit of a bum rap. I think he was not the ideal candidate to head FEMA. However, he did care about disaster management, unlike Michael Chertoff, the head of Homeland Security at the time, and still in that position. He was there, and they were dismantling his agency and farming out its various monies and functions to other agencies. And he fought that and tried to maintain the unique FEMA brand, as he called it, was ignored. And so when the disaster hit, he was in charge of this highly dysfunctional agency that wasn't working, and he was blamed for it. And it's a little bit unfair, but,
Would you think Michael Chertoff should have taken more of the blame?
Probably. I mean, there, as with other big disasters in the Bush administration, there's a tendency to not hold people accountable, and I think that was the case here. I think Michael Chertoff was really uninterested in the storm during the first hours and days into it, and unaware of what the circumstances are on the ground in New Orleans, which is really unforgivable. If you were watching TV, you knew what was going on.
Indeed. So. He was at an avian flu conference in Atlanta, I guess at the very beginning of the storm?
Right. On the day after the storm hit, he attended this flu conference. It took him a day, essentially, to recognize the scale of what was going on and begin to mobilize himself and his agency to do something.
Do you think then DHS was really, the Department of Homeland Security was really designed then to focus on terrorism after September 11th to the exclusion of a natural disaster?
Yeah, I mean, that's what people in FEMA and people who left FEMA say. Essentially, the people, if you built your career on being a natural disaster manager, you were marginalized, or your future was no longer secured because all of the institutional efforts were going into preventing terrorism. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people just said, well, my career is better in the private sector, and they left.
And we're up on a break here, but is there anything you've heard from Chertoff or DHS that gives you confidence that if and when a next big hurricane strikes, even strikes New Orleans, that they can respond?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were quite chastened by what happened and are now a lot more on top of the situation. What I'm not sure about is really, are we ready over the long term, and will we stay ready?
And that's John McQuaid, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about New Orleans and his new book called Path of Destruction, which he has co-authored with Mark Schlefstein, and it's subtitled The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY TV 12, Antiques Roadshow is in Miami, Florida, where appraisers see a pair of German-made porcelain figurines with toy bicycles in tow and a 19th-century glass vase bought at a Paris flea market. Then at 9, history detectives are in Philadelphia examining the origins of an item bought at a flea market. Examine freedom papers for an African-American man named John Jubilee Jackson. History detectives tonight at 9 on WHYY TV 12.
This Week in This American Life, what it's like for writer David Sedaris, living in France, struggling with the language.
This is my worst nightmare right here. Okay, my lighter has run out of fluid, which would mean that I would have to ask somebody for a match. And so what I would say is, hello, do you have some fire?
Americans in Paris, why the French may be right to hate us.
I will not spend the afternoon asking people if they have fire.
Wednesday night at 10 o'clock on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
So we good? We got another appointment?
Selwyn Smith left his home after Hurricane Katrina, and he is still trying to figure out how to move back a year later.
We haven't even gotten to the point where we could even start over yet. We still dealing with the stuff that happened a year ago.
Are the dollars for Katrina relief going where they're needed most? We follow the money with the first in a series of special reports next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. A year ago, Hurricane Katrina was bearing down on the Gulf region of the U.S. Within a few hours of hitting New Orleans, the city was in crisis. Thousands were stranded as the streets quickly flooded, and there was a breakdown at all levels of government. And our guests, John McQuaid and Mark Schlefstein, wrote a series of articles for the Times-Picayune, that's the New Orleans paper, back in the summer of 2002, predicting what would happen to New Orleans if hit by a big storm, and their predictions turned out to be true. They've co-authored a new book called Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John McQuaid, let me just quote something from one of your chapters, and this is a critical comment about the Bush administration. You and your co-author write, anyone who had paid attention to the Bush administration could have anticipated that blame would be shifted, authority tardily asserted. The White House might have failed miserably when it came to saving New Orleans, but it would not be so casual about saving its own skin. And you're really saying that the Bush administration put itself before the city of New Orleans and its many devastated residents.
The president is in a unique position to order men, resources, equipment anywhere in the world. If the president and Homeland Security Department had been on top of the situation on the Monday of the storm a year ago tomorrow, they could have recognized the scale of what was happening and instantly got more military resources in there, more material resources to rescue people, because as we all know, people were essentially trapped and largely inaccessible. But that didn't happen. And in fact, the Defense Department didn't want to send resources in and resisted it. And Russell Honoré, the general, didn't want to bring military resources in. And so nothing happened on that front. The governor was ordering up National Guard, and they kind of gradually entered over the course of the week. And then by the end of the week, there was this ridiculous dispute over who would be in charge of these troops, an almost entirely meaningless distinction. But the White House in particular wanted to have ultimate command over Honoré and any federal troops and the National Guard, which is under the command of the governor. So they were obsessed with that rather than actually getting the troops in there. So it just seemed ridiculous to us that this was the way things unfolded.
I was really shocked to read in your book that almost half of the National Guard, about 40% or so of the National Guard of Louisiana, was in Iraq at the time. Do you think that had anything to do in the slow response?
The National Guard Bureau claims no, but obviously the National Guard in Louisiana and nationally has been overtaxed by Iraq, and I think if more Louisiana National Guard had been in Louisiana, they could have gotten in there quicker.
Mm. How do you rate the Coast Guard and their response?
The Coast Guard gets good reviews from us and almost everybody. They, to their credit, got out there fast. They rescued in the range of 30,000 people. In our book, we have the story of one Coast Guard boat commander. He was the commander of a boat, kind of a service boat that rammed pylons and cleaned up navigable waterways. And he came down and he basically on his own set up an evacuation of St. Bernard Parish and rescued thousands of people over several days. So.
Well, why do you think the Coast Guard was able to be so responsive and other parts of the system were not?
Well, the Coast Guard, that's their job, so they're used to doing it. They had positioned resources. They have a base in New Orleans, and so they had done this drill before. They moved people out before the storm, and they moved them quickly back in. One thing, though, that they were not able to do was get people all the way out of New Orleans. They only had the capacity to rescue people in immediate danger, and transport them someplace that was less dangerous. However, the places that were less dangerous were the Superdome and the tops of levees and other things. So even, in the final stage, you need to get people all the way out, and they were not capable of doing that.
Well, let's talk a bit about the Superdome, then we'll get back to our callers. And I mean, you talked to a number of people who went there and spent some time there, and it sounded frightening, although the rumors of rapes and gangs and killings were rumors, but they became news. And I wonder if you could just talk about what it was like inside the Superdome.
It was pretty bad. It was hot, people were tense and miserable, and nobody knew when they were getting out. And so there was fear among the people there and among the National Guard and the police that were in charge nominally of the place that things might erupt at any moment. And at one point, the National Guard put out the word, we're pulling out of here. We're getting the FEMA people out of here. We think we're going to get attacked at 10 o'clock. And, of course, that was just a rumor. Mm-hmm. So if you pack thousands of people into an enclosed space, rumors will fly.
Especially if you don't have food and water, yes? People are becoming panicked because of their situation.
Right. Although at the Superdome, they did manage to keep a steady supply of food and water. It wasn't great. I mean, it was MREs and bottled water, but nobody starved. At the convention center, however, there was no support of any kind. So you had people collapsing, really, and several people dying outside in the heat.
There are so many heartbreaking stories of residents of New Orleans, and you write about Robert Green and his family. They were residents of the Ninth Ward. In fact, Robert Green had survived Betsy, and he was determined to hang out and stay with his family in his home. Help us understand what happened to him.
He through various family circumstances, had ended up not evacuating. He had tried to get his 70-something mother out of the city, but she was not up to a long car ride, and then somehow they ended up back in their Ninth Ward house. Mm-hmm. And that morning, water begins pouring into the Ninth Ward. There's a levee breach very early during the flood, and so the streets start filling with water, and then there's a very large levee breach everyone's seen pictures of, which occurs a little bit later, and a giant barge floats through it, and this is just a block or two from Robert Green's house. And so the house is literally picked up by the water and begins floating down the street. And so he and his family members chop their way out onto the roof and eventually make their way. They have to kind of swim a little bit through the water to another house. But in the middle of this, he loses one of his granddaughters, who is swept away, a little girl.
She's, what, 3 or 4 years old?
And so she's swept away by the flood, and his mother, meanwhile, has Parkinson's disease and is not doing very well, and dragged up on the roof, and eventually, a little bit later that morning, dies. So just a terrible, terrible story. And they are rescued, but then they can't take his mother's body. They have to leave it on the roof. And so one of the last sights he sees is he looks down from a bridge and he sees this body, and he becomes determined to recover the body, but is unable to for several months.
Have you kept up with his family to know how they're doing now 1 year later?
I talked to him a month or two ago, and he did not seem to be doing that well.
Mm. Let me get Mary Lou from Richmond, Virginia, to join us. Mary Lou, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'd like to ask Mr. McQuaid if there is any chance at all that the development of a technologically advanced levee system, such as the one we were discussing earlier that the Dutch have developed, if that issue is completely dead or if there's any chance at all that that could be resurrected, and if so, what it would take, is it just political will, is it what?
Okay, fair enough. John McQuaid, have you thought about that?
Yes, it's in abeyance at the moment. There is a study underway by the Corps of Engineers to look at options as to how to do that, and they're supposed to come out with a final report by the end of 2007, at which point Congress will take up the issue and decide whether to pursue this. I've seen estimates in the range of $23 billion for something truly protective. That does not include coastal restoration, which could cost another $10 or $14 billion. So you're talking many billions of dollars. So there's a real question whether the political will exists nationally to invest that much in protecting New Orleans and the Mississippi Delta area.
That's a kind of a gloomy assessment there. On your part, John McQuaid.
Well, I think it can be done, and I personally and would like to see it done, as does everybody down there. I think, you know, we spent I don't know how many hundreds of millions on Iraq. It seems like $40 million, you know, here for something for an American city should be doable. But another issue, of course, is what are other cities going to say when we spend a lot of money on New Orleans? You know, if you're in Charleston, South Carolina, you're going to say, well, I want my Category 5 levy, too. Where's my money?
So. Well, this is America, after all, isn't it? Let me get Rick from Philadelphia to join us. Rick, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yeah, hey, Marty.
Hi there.
Mr. McQuaid. Listen, last year and this year, most of the follow-up news and analysis on Katrina seem to be on the destructive effects of the physical plant of New Orleans and the port. But there were a few people who used to be talking about the destruction, the effect of the destruction on the Midwest and national economy because of the port of New Orleans on the Mississippi.
Sure.
I wonder if Mr. McQuaid could speak to that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Rick, thanks for calling into Radio Time. John McQuaid, you want to take that?
Actually, the port of New Orleans suffered some damage, but was able to come back reasonably quickly. So the commerce that comes through the Mississippi was disrupted for a while, as was oil production out in the Gulf of Mexico, and some pipelines were damaged. But all of those have since been repaired. So the actual transient economic disruption has pretty much passed.
You know, if another big storm comes up the Gulf and hits New Orleans, let's say, if not this season, this year, next year, do you think New Orleans would be ready for that?
It depends on how strong a storm it is and what angle it's coming in at and other things. If Katrina hit today, it's not clear exactly what would happen. There would be some flooding, almost certainly. One issue that is causing some anxiety is the fact that some flood walls fell down and levees were washed out, and they fixed those, but there are lots of others that could have fallen down and didn't, and they haven't really looked at those. There's all these things that were built 20 or 40 years ago, and no one is quite sure if they may contain flaws or not, and you won't know until they get hit.
Are we talking criminal negligence here?
That's for the courts to decide. People in New Orleans, they would call it criminal. I don't think the FBI will be filing charges. I think that if you were able to file a suit against the Corps of Engineers, and I think Corps of Engineers, I think you might get a jury to agree with you. But it's an open question, or I think perhaps quite difficult legally to file suit against the Corps or the U.S. government.
You don't live in New Orleans anymore. Did you leave because of the hurricane, or was there something else?
No, I was based in Washington for many years,
okay.
And so made frequent trips down there to do reporting on Washington and other things.
So this is a city that you'll be in, a situation you'll be watching carefully?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
From your perch in Washington, D.C.?
Mm-hmm.
Well, John McQuaid, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And our guest has been John McQuaid, co-author with Mark Schlefstein of a new book, and it's entitled Path of Destruction, subtitled The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms, and it's published by Little Brown. He and his co-author were part of a team of journalists for the New Orleans Times-Picayune who won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of Katrina and its aftermath. Also, our guest was with Schlefstein, the co-author of a series that ran in the New Orleans Times-Picayune a couple of years ago called Washing Away, and that predicted much of what happened last year in New Orleans, the effects of Hurricane Katrina. I'm Marty Moscoane, and that's it for this first hour of Radio Times, and you're tuned to 91 FM, WHYY FM, Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at WHYY.org.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north, then it start to rain. Rained real hard, and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River had busted through, cleared down a Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana. That tried to wash us away. That tried to wash us away. Louisiana. Louisiana. That tried to wash us away. That tried to wash us away.